You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to episode 178 of Atheistically Speaking. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. All right, well, I'm going to go to part two of the discussion with Tyler. If you remember, I had just said that it's incredibly uninteresting and boring that the Old Testament is basically just the Jews do something wrong and God tells them not to do it and then they do it and then they're punished and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then Tyler just said, well, that can all be everything you just said is because of bad hermeneutics or whatever. So we'll see if he supports that statement. We'll find out in part two. So I'm just going to go ahead and play it. Here we go.
So let me give you some concrete examples. You read through the Old Testament. You read through Judges, right?
Yeah, I read the whole Old Testament. So,
what'd you think of Judges?
Remind me. I don't know. What are we talking about?
Judges is Israel has taken the land.
It's just when several different judges rise up and they kind of lead them for a little bit, and then
they keep falling, they keep messing up. Yeah. Other people keep taking over. Judge rises up, redeems them, and then they go on their merry way, right? All that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Horrible book, good book, terrible book, pointless book.
That one, I think the repetitiveness was really, really boring. I would say it's not the worst. I would say it's somewhere in the middle in the Old Testament in terms of how bad it was, in my opinion. Sure.
Right. So the entire point – this is why hermeneutics is important, right? Not just understanding the genre, but also understand the literary features, the themes that are developed, right? So if you read it as a piece of literature – again, everything I'm about to say – it doesn't matter whether you think it's true, false, inspired, inerrant, whatever, right? When I'm talking about hermeneutics, I'm just talking about reading it as a piece of literature.
Sure.
Right? Reading it as what the author said. So you could entirely think that Israel, you know, is a post-exilic invention and still completely follow what I'm trying to say, right? I'm not here making an appeal for biblical.
Sure. I'll go with that.
So Judges, I pick Judges for a reason, because Judges comes up a lot when I'm talking with atheists. And they say the Bible condones rape, right? How can you believe the Bible? Because the Bible tells you that it's okay to rape someone. And a lot of times they'll point to the passage in Judges where it talks about the Levite having a concubine and the Levite offering over his concubine to be basically gang raped all night and then killed. Then he cuts her up and then sends her all to the tribes, right? And they say, well, how can you affirm a Bible that so affirms, you know, rape? Really, what that person has just said is, I don't know how to read. And I don't
well,
mean that.
I'd like
I don't
to
mean
make
that in a
very
mean
clear
way.
That,
I mean
that is not at all the claim I've made. I don't think I've ever made that claim.
No. I'm not saying that that's your claim.
Okay.
Right. I'm using this as an example, and then I'll kind of go back to your claim. One of the major problems there is that they're confusing description with prescription. Right. Describing something with prescribing something. But what? So now this that so that's their problem. That's not your problem. That's not the claim you're making. The problem when it comes to you is, so the concubine story is at the very end of Judges, right? It's the last couple chapters of the book of Judges. The whole point of that very end is that Israelite is so bad, right? They've gotten so, which by the way undermines, I constantly in my adult Sunday school class go over the kind of moralism where, you know, be like David, be like Daniel. 99% of the time, the Bible is saying don't be like that. I mean, it doesn't come out and say, don't rape your concubine, right? Or don't offer up your concubine for gang rape. It doesn't come out and explicitly say, this is bad. But when you're reading through the text, the whole point of the narrative is that Israel has gotten so bad that you have a wandering Levite, right? A Levite's supposed to be a priest serving at the temple in Bethel right now. You have a wandering Levite who basically gets hired by a family so he can just bless them, right? It turns God into like a private deity just for this family. He has a concubine, which he's not supposed to have, right? The men of Benjamin have become worse than Sodom and Gomorrah is one of the major points. So you have kind of the end of this really downward spiral. Now I'll get to your point. Going back through the book of Judges, if you read it carefully and you read it closely, what happens throughout the book of Judges is, starting at the very beginning, if you picture it like a big funnel, and it starts really big on the bottom, it gets really narrow on the bottom. The entire point, and why it's repetitive, right? You caught on that it's repetitive, which is good, because the entire book is a big cycle.
Entire Bible is
cycle.
Repetitive, but yeah, sure.
It's a big cycle all the way down, because it goes from, you have the judge at the very beginning. You have one person, and he saves Israel by using the entire Israeli army. He's able to do it with lots of people, and they're spared for a very long period of time. As you go down, Israel gets worse and worse and worse. The judges become less and less effective with less and less people, and their judgment is effective for less and less amount of time, until finally you get all the way down to Samson. Samson's a horrible guy, right? We just shouldn't look at Samson as a moral example. He's a terrible guy for the most part. You have one guy who's redeeming Israel single-handedly by himself, right? He can't use other people, and his salvation that he gets only lasts basically for, you know, basically his lifetime, and that's about it. So the whole point of that cycle is that it's this downward spiral, right? So when I'm talking about, you know, it being a, you know, the Bible written as a piece of literature, as a work of art, we're talking about those types of theme developments, those type of the authors using intentional structures, the author, you know, there's all these literary devices that happen, that whether or not you think it's true or false, it's very, very, it literarily, it's beautiful, right?
I think you've misunderstood my criticism of the Bible, or maybe I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, but it's possible you should listen to my show. Because my main criticism,
here's
my criticism. First off, I think you're confusing, like, you know, you've said how atheists still confuse, prescription with description, or vice versa. Yep. I think you've confused being able to identify a literary strategy with that literary strategy therefore being good. I think that you go through the Bible and you say, ah, here's the strategy. You're missing the strategy. This is repeating for a purpose. And I'm saying, yeah, no, I get that. It's just not good. It's like if I heard a song that had 4,200 choruses. It's like, yeah, I get that they're trying to be repetitive. They're trying to make a song that will be catchy. I hate it. It's too much. It's bad writing. And it's fine. That's a matter of – I understand that's a matter of opinion. But yeah, I would go through and be able to defend my opinion very well, I think. If I took – especially if I went back through the entire Bible, the entire Old Testament, I would be able to make a pretty good case for why it's terrible writing. And that's fine. If we're just dealing with the claim of, is this good literature? Is this a brilliant work of art? No, it's not, in my mind. And nothing you've said has changed my mind on that. I understand that you can have a difference of opinion. That's fine. But I don't think it's fair to say that I'm insane for thinking something that hasn't been the widespread view, which is that I don't think it's good. I think it's been given too much reverence as purely as a piece of literature. The other thing I'll say, I have never... confuse the prescription with description. Well, I mean, that's a strong term. I don't think that's what I've been doing. I think that when in the Old Testament, when you have instances of God telling people to do stuff, then it's fair to say God is endorsing this. I don't think – I've never said, here's what's happening. Or I would say if a character in the Old Testament has done something and God has rewarded them for it, then God is endorsing it. Would that be fair, or are you going to say that it's some poetry or something that I'm missing out on?
No, I would need an example, to be honest.
Well, I mean, you have Malachites,
you know,
I'm sure
so
you thought
of that a lot. I listen to this show regularly. I listen to your other one kind of sporadically.
I normally
want to, like, you know, high five you. On the other show, I normally want to throw your podcast out the window. So
hey, understood. I don't think you should listen to it if you are the only reason I said that is because I think you would hear that my criticism is with broader themes, and here's one. So you've just brought up the fact that, okay, here's the point of Judges. It's that they're so bad. The Israelites are so bad. Sure. Who chose the Israelites? Did I or did God? Because I didn't choose them. I didn't choose to follow this piece of shit people that keeps doing things wrong. They're talking to God. They have communication with God. They've seen miracles. Why are they so dumb? Why are they so incompetent that they can't follow simple directions of the God that they're actually supposedly talking to?
Right.
And God is the one who chose them. Why did he choose them? Why didn't God choose an Asian culture or anyone else? Someone, right. A culture capable of receiving the simplest instruction and carrying it out. That's a problem I have that I don't see that you've undermined with your talk of poetry or of literature of whatever, you know? I mean, that's a broad thing.
And again, you know, I'm more talking about hermeneutics in general. So you're asking more theological questions in those kinds of cases.
These are the things – sorry, I'll just interject quickly. That is the kind of – the reason I said, you know, you hadn't listened to my show is that's the kind of criticism I have more often. That's the thing. I mean, there's no – I don't think hermeneutics explains that. That's a broad theme of God and a reason I think the Bible is dumb. Now, admittedly, I guess that wouldn't be like a literary reason. You're right. It might be more of a theological reason. Mm-hmm. But it's something that's the kind of thing that I think is a problem. But similarly, I would say when you're talking about God prescribing horrible things, that's not a literary problem. That's a theological problem. Because as far as literature is concerned, God can prescribe whatever the hell he wants as long as it's good literature, right?
Right. And so – but I'm going to say a lot of this does come back to hermeneutics. So for example, why did God pick the Hebrews?
You got me. I have no idea.
The point of the Old Testament, is it because they're so fantastic?
I don't know. He chose to give them rewards that he wasn't going to give anyone else. So either there has to be some merit to it or God is incredibly unjust.
Yeah. See, again, I think that those are false dichotomies. So and I think that reading – so another part of the problem is going to come about where reading texts kind of in isolation of other texts is going to be a problem. So when you read through the entire Old Testament – it's hard to come away thinking that God chose them because the Israelites are so fantastic, right? It's not a meritorious thing. Why does God have to choose anyone?
Why does he have to choose a bit? Why wouldn't he choose everybody? I mean, I'm not trying to be sarcastic or anything. This is a major problem I have with the entire book.
Yeah, and that's going to be again a different type of problem. It's going to be a different type of question that you're even asking at that point.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me just make the
point that when I say the Bible is terrible, I was including those questions. So when I say the Old Testament sucks, I'm including that thing. So if we wanted to try to isolate more to like the literary problems, then I suppose it's not worth talking about those problems. It's more worthwhile talking about the fact that it's way too repetitive. It doesn't need to be that repetitive. But I don't know. I think that might be the reason I branched off a bit is I think that's more of an opinion discussion than a point of fact. But I'll let you continue.
But again, so the repetitive nature actually might partially be the answer to your question, though. So when you're teaching something, I honestly don't know what you do for a living, or if you've ever had to teach a seminar or a class or anything, repetition is one of the largest, you know, pedagogical tools that you're going to use, especially if you're dealing with people that are known to be forgetful. So part of the answer to your question is going to basically be, well, you know, the Jews aren't special, but they're representative. I don't know if you or I would have done any better in those situations. We like to think we would, but I honestly don't think we would have done that much better, if better at all. Especially people at large. Repetition is going to be one of the most important things. So especially when you're dealing with long spans of time. So we have that common saying that those who you know forget their history are bound to repeat it. Well, Israel needed to constantly be reminded because they kept repeating the same problem over and over again. So I think that repetition. I know that it drives you nuts, and you said you don't think it should happen, you know, that much to that degree. But I actually think there's a point to that much repetition, and I don't think we see a repetition to the degree where it's really all that obnoxious. And I should say this with a caveat that I'm probably, you know, I'm not trying to say that I'm like some fantastic, you know, biblical, you know, exegete who just loves every single verse. I mean, I skim the genealogies. I skim the dietary laws, right? I mean, if I'm writing a paper for my master's degree, I might do some research and read through those passages. For the most part, honestly, I'm skimming large sections of law, and I'm skimming sections of
And I think that's what has caused this misconception that the Bible is a good piece of art, because when you actually have to read it all, it's very difficult to suffer through.
Well, I think it depends. I mean, if you're talking about it as a literary whole, I think it's fantastic. If you're talking about certain verses, well, they're important. They set the stage. They set the context. They help you understand some of the historical details. That it sets it kind of in its sits in Laban, its situation in life, right? I mean, there are important things to that, but it doesn't mean that I don't think that just because something is a great piece of literature that every single passage has to be riveting. So there's that kind of portion of it as well. I think kind of moving beyond that, because I think we both said what we can say on that. It's probably not going to be much movement on either side.
Sure. Then I'll say one last thing. I think that it's my opinion that you've set the bar way lower. If you were reading any other book, especially a book that is as long as this one, just as a piece of literature, because that's what we're judging. We're judging it. We're comparing it to other literature. If you read anything that wasn't the Bible that was that bad, I truly believe that you would not have the same reaction.
I don't know. I read War and Peace.
Yeah, but it's way better.
And I skimmed the section with all of the Russian names that I don't understand.
Well, there you go. That could be a weakness of War and Peace. But the repetition is so, and the fact that I thought it was funny that you were saying, yeah, in order to teach the Jews who aren't exceptional, you need to repeat. And even that didn't work. So it's amazing. But
doesn't work. I mean, we have people who read and memorize the Bible and all the repetition. We still make the same mistakes today. So, it's repetition is helpful, but it's not like it's going to make people perfect.
Well, there's another option, perhaps an easier option that would allow for people who don't need the repetition to deal with it, is just to write the thing once. And then have God say, if you get this wrong, read it again. Read it as many times, almost like music. Go back to the coda or whatever. Whenever you find yourself not following this, read again. I don't need 4,900 examples of the same way that the Jews violated whatever, doing the same thing over and over again.
Well, again, to be honest. So, for example, I just taught this section in the adult Sunday school class this morning, so it's on my mind. In Exodus 14, there's a repetition of the laws about the Passover. And one of the questions is, why in the space of, you know, a chapter and a half does it repeat all of the regulations about the Passover supper again? What's the point? Well, you know, the entire point is, if you read the text in the situation in life, well, the first set was to the children of Israel. They're in Goshen. It's right before the 10th plague. They're actually being told about the Passover for the night of Passover to prepare for the night. That's the regulations. Those regulations carry on to the Passover meal. So the next chapter is about the Passover meal. Well, who's joined the children of Israel, right? It says a mixed multitude came out with the children of Israel out of Egypt. So now you have Israel, and you have a bunch of other Semites and Egyptians that are leaving Egypt with them. And so you have the retelling of the law, because effectively you have a different audience, even though it's only a chapter apart, right? And so you have the retelling
of
the law for a purpose.
I don't understand. So are you saying when was it written? Because you're just recounting, they were recounting history, right? It's not like they were writing it as they were going along, or is it? I mean, I don't know the specifics of that particular book.
Yeah, and that's gonna vary depending on your view. If you think it's been, even people who hold to, say, Mosaic authorship normally hold to some type of redaction, because Moses doesn't talk about his own death.
You very easily could just say, and they retold the laws that we just mentioned.
But there's a difference. So the initial set of laws, even though there's a lot of the similarities, the second set of laws is directly addressing to who can take the Passover, right? Because it's dealing now with, well, how do you handle all of these Semites and non-Israelites that are now among the Israel? They're going to want to partake in the Passover meal too, and they're allowed to, but here's some of the stipulations that they have to meet to do it, right? It's addressing a different situation. So the repetition isn't, it's not like it's repeating the exact same thing, right? It repeats it. Normally, if there's repetition, there's a twist. There's a thematic change. There's a situation change, right? There's something like that that happens that causes some type of repetition to be needed. Although, like I said, it's almost never just a straight repetition of the exact same thing over again for the same purpose to the same people, right? It's not that type of repetition. So when you see repetition, repetition was one of the way that Hebrew literature and most ancient Near Eastern literature would develop themes through repetition. Right. And this is one of those examples. So it's just kind of it's just a minor point. But
all I know is I taught it this morning, so it was on my book. Mind. And I understood. And I think that you do a good job of coming up with a good explanation of some things. But I think I would go back to when I'm saying identifying a strategy does not mean that it's good. It really doesn't. Yeah. I mean, if I read a book, any book that repeated the amount that this does, I would not want to read it. It's mind numbing. Especially, right. I want to know what your explanation of the arc is, because they literally say, here's a million years of instructions for precisely how to build this arc. This will be 5 cubits. This will be 11 cubits. This will be purple. And then they literally just change it to, and then they built it. And this was 5 cubits. And this was 11 cubits. And this, they built this. What in the earth? Do you have an explanation for that?
You'll find if you keep talking to me, if I haven't completely turned you off or anything like that, you'll find that a lot of what I think about things in the Bible are, I don't always have an answer, but I think that sometimes I have a hint in the right direction, if that makes sense.
All right.
I think that one of the major themes in the Pentateuch is the need to be obedient. It's one of the major challenges. I mean, it's Israel wandered the wilderness because they were disobedient. Moses died without going to the promised land because he was disobedient, right? I mean, obedience is a major problem in the Old Testament. So the need for obedience is like one of the predominant themes.
Ooh, I just got a great creative literature solution for you. And the Israelites did exactly what God said. Done. End of sentence.
Yeah. So again, there's a reason why they're not modern.
Or why not go into more detail? And the Israelites stepped 5 feet to the right, and he raised his. I mean, if you're saying they need to go into that great detail for some reason, why not go into more detail? Why that level of detail?
I don't know. Again, I, like I said, I don't have an answer. I have what I think is an answer in the right direction. Right? I think it's reinforcing they did what they were told, because sometimes it says and they did what God said, right? And it doesn't reiterate. Other times it says, and they did exactly, and then it basically recounts the they did, and then it says each one of the commands that they were told to do. It happens in the law. It happens throughout. So it's a certain type of literature. Again, I agree with you. Identifying the structure doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to like it. But at that point, then it's just, we're now in the realm of opinion. I might say, well, you know, I don't like Picasso's blue period because it's too much blue. So you know, I can understand that it's a matter of opinion. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we should, be free to read. So going all the way back to the beginning, where you said, well, I'm not trying to misrepresent what it means. I'm trying to address the question of, well, first we got to know what it means, right? And knowing what it means isn't always as clear as just kind of reading it tabula rasa, right? Reading it kind of just as a blank slate. We just come to the English text and we'll instantly get it.
Granted.
Right?
Understood.
So, I mean, because I think that that type of assumption, and honestly, you know, like I said, I listen sporadically to your other one when I'm feeling, you know, especially masochistic. Mm-hmm. I listen to it, and sometimes I give you a hard time. It's not always as bad as I'm making out to be, if that's a backhanded compliment.
Well, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I just think we have a fundamental disagreement. I think your baseline belief is this is a good piece of literature because God wrote it. Or God had a hand in it in some way. And I just think that will not reliably produce a good conclusion. I mean, that's my opinion of what's happening here, because it's not well written. And I think that I will grant you, though, that I'm sure there are places where I'm missing the meaning because of translation problems, because of I don't understand the historical context. I would not pretend, and I think that's a point that you are much more educated on than I am, that I would not argue with that if there's times I'm getting the meaning wrong. But I do think the overall themes, I have a lot of critiques. That's why I started talking about them earlier, about why are they the chosen people? Why did God do this? Why did God do that? That aren't really dependent on minutia that I might be interpreting incorrectly.
Well, I think sometimes they are. I mean, that's probably a topic for a different.
Especially, we're already over an hour. I think we're going to have to try to start wrapping up. I don't mean immediately, but. There's anything you've wanted to get to that you haven't, I'd recommend.
Yeah, so I had some examples to address. Again, you know, these aren't the type that you normally make, but you're going to have some of your audience, I'm sure, just still throw up their hands and say, well, the Bible's nonsense. You know, why do I have to? And then they're going to go out and say things like, you know, the Bible says that pi equals 3, or they're going to say the Bible says bats are birds. Right. So, some of those types of issues.
Feel free to explain those. I have heard both of those. I'm sure there are listeners of mine who agree with both of those. So feel free to explain those. I'll give you the chance to fight
back.
So
this is a hermeneutics issue because, you know, there's a passage in First Kings where it says, you know, he's talking about making a bronze basin. And it says that it's 10 cubits, right? A cubit is basically the length of your forearm up to the tip of your finger. That it's 10 cubits from rim to rim, and it's 30 cubits around. And they're going to say, well, that's 1/3, right? And a circle, right, is that difference should be pi. It shouldn't be, you know, 1/3. It should be 3.14, whatever. Yeah. Right? And they're going to say, well, see, the Bible's wrong because it says pi equals 3. I'm trying not to be sarcastic, but part of me just wants to say, look, that's just not how, I mean, if I'm talking about something, I'm not going to say that's 3.14, right? Whatever. I mean, you know, it's about 1/3.
So the guy is approximating and that end of story.
Yeah.
Have I gotten to that? Was that Old Testament?
That was First Kings.
I don't even remember that. That's weird.
It's probably one of the things that you passed because it's talking about all the appliances that are going to go in the temple.
I read every single thing, but I probably just didn't. See, I'm with you. I actually don't find that one that important, especially given the fact that it is in just where all these things are going. It's not like it would be one thing if the Bible said, and God said pi is exactly 3, or, you know, or God said this should be precisely 20, you know, whatever he said, 30, and then this will be precisely 10. That might be a different story. The fact that it's not really God saying it, right? Or is it?
Right.
Is he giving instructions, or is this when someone is doing something?
But it also, you have to remember, it's set in cubits. A cubit was literally the person would measure by measuring their forearm
precise.
The end of their palm or their right. It's not an exact.
So I'm going to go ahead and say I agree with you on that one. I think that's a good point. I haven't brought that one up, and I will continue not to because I don't really think it's that great of a criticism.
Yeah.
So what about the birds or bats or birds?
One of them, it's talking about the list of animals that you can't eat. And among the birds, it says bats. Right? You don't eat bats, cave bats.
All right.
Right? Not allowed to. And a lot of people were like, well, that's stupid, right? Bats aren't birds, right? It's a mammal, right? It's not a bird. And they make this big thing about it. And it's like, well, there's a couple problems with it. First of all, taxonomy is an entirely artificial thing that we make up based on similar traits. What really happened in the ancient world, the word for bird, right? They didn't use birds in our modern taxonomical
sense. Yeah, see, I would have suspected this was more of a translation thing. I mean, I'm sure that there wasn't a precise word for
it was winged things.
Yeah,
as opposed to swarming things, which is how they talk about insects, right? You had winged things and you had swarming things. You had flying birds and you had insects, right?
You know what? I think you're right about this too. I don't actually think that's a big deal, and I think that's a good point. So
these are examples though of hermeneutic issues. And when you read through things like Merit's lists of Bible contradictions or evilbible.org and all those types of lists. These are the types of things that you're coming
across. I think you're
right.
I think some of these are exaggerated. I think that the important ones are probably more broad. Sometimes I poke little jokes at translation things in my Bible that I'm reading because it's just too funny. Like there's just some words that are just so dumb that turns a phrase. But I mean, I will acknowledge it's probably a translation thing.
Yeah.
But they're,
especially
they're,
if you're reading through the – I forget. You're reading through
King
the
James.
NIV. Is that right?
No, King James.
You're reading
–
yeah. See,
that
King James
the
has
one that everyone
unicorns.
Said – Sorry, what's that?
You have unicorns in the King James, which is always fun.
Oh, yeah. That was – but I chose the King James. Admittedly, I didn't know much about it. I just needed to choose one. But I chose it because that was the one I had heard most oft referenced as this is the great piece of literature. Like the King James Version is the most poetic, the most whatever. So that's why I chose that. I wanted to try to give it all the credit I could. But I don't know. Maybe I chose the wrong version.
Yeah, King James. Well, the King James is 16th century English. So even words it uses don't have the same meanings today.
It
can use the word gentleman. And when we think of gentleman, we think of a very polite man. When it uses gentleman, it means a landowner. Right. So, you know, words, even in English, change meaning. So I know we got to wrap up. So I came up with what I think is a really good example of kind of historical, theological, cultural, literary translation, kind of all like the perfect storm of hermeneutics on one passage that's so commonly misunderstood and so often used as an objection to the Bible, right? I didn't listen to the one I used, or no? I don't remember. I was just about to confess and beg your forgiveness, mea culpa. I'm sorry. I didn't actually go back into your catalog and pull up this episode to see if you addressed it. I should have, right?
That's okay.
It's Elisha and the Bears.
Oh.
Right? I'm sure you have. I'm sure you touched on it.
God murders a bunch of kids for – no, wait. Yeah, God sends some bears.
The two Shea Bears come out and it kills a bunch of kids.
Oh, I can't wait to hear your explanation of this one. Okay, right? Let's go.
So do you remember how you presented it? I can't say this is an indictment of you because I don't know how you presented it.
I think that's been a long time. That's been probably, I would guess, I don't know, 3 years since I did that episode. So it'd be hard for me to remember, but I do remember it. And I do remember, I mean, I remember that content. And I think if I had to guess, I think I read it and said, well, that's awful. I mean, that guy, I mean, it's just an awful thing that's described. I don't know. I didn't get too much into what the background would be. I just said, well, that's like a horrendous story, and I can't believe that happened.
Yeah, because when you read it and you read the surface text, it sounds like they made fun of a guy for being bald.
Being bald, yeah.
A bunch of little kids.
Yeah.
And he didn't like being called bald, and so he called on his big brother God, and God was protecting
all
his
right.
little brother.
So
and
what really happened? Let's see.
Right? This is a really good example because you have so many background issues that go into why this story is there. And again, I'm not saying this to say that the story is true. I'm not even saying it to say the story is ethical. But we should at least know what the story is saying.
Okay.
Right? That's the whole point of hermeneutics. What is the author even trying to say? You have to know what it says before you can evaluate whether it's true, before you can evaluate whether it's ethical. Chances are when I tell you this, you might change what you understand the story to be saying. I doubt you're going to change whether you think God is being ethical or not.
All right.
So first a couple things. The children. We think of little doe-eyed, traveling t-ball team kids, right? Little kids.
They're actually little shits. Is that what you're going to say?
Basically. No. So the Hebrew word is na'ar. It's basically a word that can mean – It covers someone up to like their late 20s, right? It kind of means like what we would think of as a young adult.
All right.
It's that type of word. So it's right off the bat when you read these and it says youths, right? If you think of a youth, right? Even now we can think about someone being in their youth is still in their 20s, right? They're still in their youth. That was especially common during your reading King James. It would have said youths. That was still common in King James, you know, 17th century England. Your life expectancy was, you know, in your 40s. When you're 20, you're an adult. So, but you were a youth. You were a young man, right? You're not a child. A lot of translations says child. Another problem is, I don't know if you remember, but there are 42 of them that are mauled, right? So when the bears come out, they attack 42 of them.
I don't remember that there was that many. Jeez.
So
this guy must have been really bald.
That's right. And that's just the ones that were bald or were mauled, right? How many do you think got away? Because it's two bears, right? They got 42 of them. Chances are there was more, right? So this isn't some traveling like t-ball team of doe-eyed little kids, right? In this time and place, we're talking about the it's after the division of the monarchy. There's no more king. You have little principalities, little city states that are arising and expressing power, and you have what normally would be a check and balance on what are kind of roaming bands of brigands that are going around and kind of like highway robbers. They assault people as they're out, right? So you have these little militia forces that go through and travel around, and they assault travelers, right? This is one of the problems. You read it through the prophets, where it talks about how you assault the innocent on the highways, right? We think of highway like, you know, freeways. Highways were just their roads. You're out traveling. Mm-hmm. So this is most likely we're talking about a mob of brigands that are out to assault people. We know that when they say "go up, bald man," "go up, bald man," "go up" was their basically way of it was an assault. It was like saying, "Why don't you die? You should be dead. You're going to die," right? That's kind of the intent. Now, especially if it's coming from 42 plus men in a militia, right? If you were by yourself wandering and you have a militia of 42 people come at you and saying, "You're going to die, you're going to die," do you take that as, "Oh, that's sweet," or do you take that as a threat on your life, right? I mean, so it's not just kind of this innocent, you know, "go up, go up." They call it bald. We think of bald and we think of male pattern baldness. Balding for them, again, the Hebrew, didn't actually necessarily mean you were bald. People with leprosy, people who were outsiders, people who were considered to be like the untouchable, they could have been called bald, right? The view was you're an outsider, you're sickly, you're untouchable, you're the scum of the earth type of that. That's really what the intent of that type of term would have been. So you have this gang basically saying, "We're going to kill you, you worthless man." And where are we historically? Again, we're in a time after the divided kingdom. He's going to Bethel, which is supposed to be the center of worship for God's people. But right now you have this group of people that are basically assaulting God's people as they travel to the tabernacle or to the temple. Well, preventing them from going and offering their offerings or going to worship Yahweh and probably beating and stealing and killing and some of the people who are bringing their tithes and their sin offerings. So they're actually getting in the way of the purity of the people. When we come to the passage, when you understand the history and the literature and kind of everything that's happening at this point, where it's this band of brigands who are actually physically threatening his life, and it's the prophet of God, and they're getting in the way of people coming and worshiping God. Now, again, it doesn't mean that I doubt you suddenly are like, "Oh, hallelujah, Corius, it's true, God is great," right? But it's going to be a completely different meaning than if you just read the King James and be like, "Well, that's awful, right? Why did he kill a bunch of kids for saying this guy's bald?"
Yeah, all right. I would want to research that a little bit just to make sure. But yeah, I can accept that as a definitely a much different scenario. Is it translated any differently in different versions or?
You're going to have – so, I mean, it doesn't trans – because really the only translational issue – is the word na'ar, which is translated youth, right? And youth, like I said, even in English can still mean a youth. It can still mean someone in their 20s. But some translations say youth, some say young men, some say little ones. So, I mean, it can be translated as different terms.
All right.
But a lot of this is coming from just the historical context. Where are we at? It's also, remember a long time ago at the very beginning, I talked about literary couplets that they use. This is another example. So the passage that just preceded this, when Elisha was in a different city, those people responded in faith and there was a miracle of healing. This people responded with violence and there was a, you know, quote unquote miracle, of justice or of wrath. So it's actually, it's a couplet narrative where it's comparing the faith of two different groups, right? So that type of literary repetition is there as well. So again, like I said, you know, you probably aren't suddenly like, you know, "Praise God, that's great." But it's a different example. It's just a good example of saying, well, why is hermeneutics important, right? Why is it that understand the context is important? Because there's so many times where I talk about this and they're like, "Well, you know, you're just appealing to con." And I've literally had atheists say, "Well, you know, we don't need to understand context. You just need to read the text," right? And I'm just going to be like, well, this is the same objection I get from Christian fundamentalists who are, you know, King James only. And they're going to say, "Well, you don't need to read the Greek. Just read the King James only. If it's good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me," right? I mean, it's that type of response. Well, I want to say, well, no, if we're going to be responsible readers, right? I'm not saying you have to believe in inerrancy or believe, just if you want to be a responsible reader, there's a certain level where we have to hold our superficial reading of the text really loosely and say, I'm reading this as on the plane, kind of the prima facie on the face of it of the English text. If something comes across as really, really weird, it could be really, really weird, or it could just be that it's a, I'm not understanding something about the history. I'm not understanding about something about the culture. Understanding hospitality laws in the ancient Near East will go really far.
Sure, but there's obviously a line between that and assuming. There are people who read it as, if God is doing something wrong, I'm misunderstanding it, which will get you into trouble just as much, I would think. So I understand that.
That's and actually, it does. Again, just in my sentence, it's just fresh on my mind because I taught it this morning. I already talked to my class today about saying, you know, there's we don't need to rescue God. A lot of what passes for apologetics is just attempts to say, well, it looks like God's done something really, really bad. Well, what type of hula hoops can we jump through to make it okay?
Hmm.
And a lot of times when I read through those, I'm just like, well, that's just as bad of exegesis as, you know, reading that it's 42 little children getting killed for calling some guy bald. Right? Those are equally bad.
Well, I wish it had been translated a little better then or something, because it is pretty misleading. But understood. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on, Tyler. I think we likely could find a lot more to talk about, and I'd be happy to do so. So let me know if you ever have something more you want to come on and discuss, because it was fun. I liked it a lot.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'll have to have you on my show sometime.
I'm in anytime.
I'll give you the steering wheel of mine like you've given me the steering wheel of yours.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Is there anything? So you want to promote your show? Feel free to plug anything you want.
Sure. It's just the Freed Thinker podcast. It's available on iTunes, Stitcher, and then there's the Facebook group, the Freed Thinker group.
Cool. Do you have a Twitter or anything that you want people to follow?
I do, but it's so sporadic.
Sure. All right. Well, Freed Thinker podcast, Tyler Vella. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for Tyler. Thank you so much, Tyler, for coming on. That was a fun discussion. I'm sure we could have gone on for quite a long time. I also want to thank my patrons so much. You can always support me at patreon.com/atheist. Now is a great time to support me. I mean, there's no way that they're going to get hacked again. They fixed that problem, so they're probably safe, and they're probably paying extra attention to it. So I actually have three new patrons maybe four. Rex Hammer, thank you so much. Patricia Mueller, I think. Sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. And Columbia House Holdings, LLC. Good story behind that. If you're curious for that story, go listen to all of Comedy Shoosh. Suffice to say, it was really good. It was a really good joke that this patron, whose name I still don't know, it's a really good one. So go check that out. Jimmy Miles, thank you. Thank you to my four new patrons. Very impressive. Very heartwarming. Much appreciated. Thank you for supporting the show and helping me bring you cool stuff like this interview, like the debate I had. Got more exciting stuff in the future. So that's patreon.com/atheist if you'd like to support my work. And with that said, I'll see you next week for a couple new episodes. It seems to be the pattern here, so I guess that's what we'll do. Adios.